Bill Cundiff. And we have a sponsor this hour, Pepe Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. Pepe has everything you need when it comes to John Deere and a great staff up there. And you go up and see them, and they'll make you a great deal on a new mower, tractor, parts service. They do it all up there. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call. Their number is 530-226-9226. And they'll be there all next week, Friday included, right before Christmas. Put a mower under the tree. That'll make somebody happy. Or you can catch them on the web at pappymachinery.com.
Oh, sure. Easy for you to say.
Yeah. It's just a little tricky when you drive them in there. Under, it's kind of hard to hide it. Uh-huh. But, yeah, you can do it.
Considering the things we saw stuck in people's equipment, my snowblower won't work. It's broken.
Yeah.
Oh, it has a spark plug stuck in the
rotor. Yeah, that doesn't work.
You did snow blowing on a spark plug. Not a manufacturer defect. Oh, my goodness. So, let's see. Today is December 18th, 2022, in case we replay this at another time. But just kind of fair warning here, the Christmas lands on Sunday. New Year's lands on Sunday. So we will be rolling archives for the next 2 weeks. And just so happens it perfectly coincides with a major revamp on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. Have to change it around a bit because I've hit the page limit. So anyway, it's going to be converted over. Should look the same, but should perform better, actually. And I'll be able to add some new things, but won't be able to get to that until it's slated to take like probably 3 weeks maybe. So you can check the archives for live shows we do in January. You can just check the archive link, and I'll post it there. I won't be able to create new pages for the shows, but we'll just have to make do. I know you guys are all flexible. So anyway, the information will be there. The shows will continue. Nothing bad has happened. We just had a little – we just ran out of page space.
Yeah.
Simple.
So Nathan's page will be up for 3 weeks.
Yeah, his page will be up like forever. Oh, right. He's like the guy. I called him to upgrade the thing, and they're like, oh, we don't support that platform anymore. Huh? Oh, you'll have to build your site again. I'm like, it's over 500 pages. I can't rebuild the site. Oh, well, we have a guy. They can do it. I was like, oh, thank you.
We have a guy. Everybody has a guy.
Thank God for the guy. All right. So our guest today, Nathan Deschmaker. And he's from, I don't know if he's from Montana. I'm assuming he's from Montana. At least he lives there now. And they raise registered feeder calves in central Montana, just in case you were curious. There's a great picture up on the site, too. You should go look at it. Kind of makes you wish you were there, but it looks kind of chilly. He's a senior research associate and policy analyst specializing in federal and local government administrative procedures, land and natural resource policymaking, local government relations, and program management. Nathan's also an accomplished musician. He doesn't say what he plays, though. We're going to have to have more information on that. And a self-taught theologian with a love for the classics. Nathan has worked with local government to identify and challenge attacks on small farm and ranch operations facing increased pressure and regulation by forces and groups outside of Montana and many times outside the U.S. So before you think, well, this doesn't affect me because I don't live in Montana and I don't raise cattle. Hey, guess what? This does affect you because all of the crazy ideas that the federal government is doing through the bureaucracy, a lot of that, the only way to go after it is through all this administrative procedure failings. I mean, they cut corners, but if you don't know the rules, you can't fight back. So
yeah, unless you like soy burgers and soy fries.
Yeah, and you want to live in a big city.
Yeah,
yeah, great, everybody's dream. So anyway, I think you'll find this really really interesting and full of thought and resources. All right, so Nathan, first we need to know what instrument do you play? Just in case we get all carried away and forget.
Yeah, well, initially the drums, play the drums, but the last 5, 6, 7 years mainly we just playing piano. Did it kind of backwards. They tried to make me play piano in school, and I didn't want to, so I got a drum set and played the drums, and now I'm playing piano. So
they were right all the time.
Funny how that works. Well, good for you. So we spoke the other day about, you know, the wide range of all of this, but I kind of left it to you to steer us on how you want to attack it.
Yeah, well, just on some of your comments for your audience, I guess I can clarify a couple things. One, I am from, born and raised in Montana.
Oh, there you go.
I grew up on a cattle ranch. So yep, that's where I've been most of my life. I have the opportunity to work with people outside of the state in Washington State and other states, Kansas and elsewhere on some of the work that we've been doing on, because like you said, a lot of these bureaucratic rulemaking processes really does affect many, many times, not just one county or one state, but are reach across multiple states. So we've been working in those areas. The reason I got into that, just real quick for your audience,
yes, we had
an organization come into Montana, American Prairie Reserve, over 20 years ago, really, is when they started. But they have a vision and goal of buying up large amounts of private inholdings, and which is privately owned land that is surrounded by BLM, in this case, mostly Bureau of Land Management, federal land. So their goal, just in a nutshell, is 3.5 million acre prairie reserve, removing all the development that's put in place over the years through our domestic livestock industry, and put aside pretty much the same size of the state of Connecticut, right in the heart of Montana, back to passive preservation and bringing bison back, apex predators, and having a large wildlife reserve. So that's one thing, at least in on the Montana front, that shifted my interest and focus in some of the work I do with history and law on understanding how local governments, where we live, if we live in this country, state and your counties or your town, play into serving as a check when our federal counterparts are implementing processes that are coming from outside special interest groups. So that's a little bit of background on how I got involved in some of the policy work in relationship to federal rulemaking.
It's a minefield, though. I mean, it's full of complexity, and I'm sure you've never experienced this. I might have experienced it once or twice, but the agencies will bamboozle you until you bust them with their own rules,
with their own interpretation.
You know, I mean, they'll write their own stuff unless you can kind of stop them.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the problem, is we've kind of lost ball on there's been a lot of delegated authority to these agencies, and then over time, they, like you said, they start putting forward regulations, rulemaking, and all these different things, and they function off policy manuals, guidance documents, and whatnot, and often those guidance documents have departed from the organic authorities that our Congress initially delegated over for those departments. So that's part of what I do, is really understanding the organic authorities, starting really with the Constitution. That's the fundamental framework, the cornerstone of our Republican system of government, separation of powers and the foundations there, and then understanding what Congress has delegated to these agencies, and like you said, coming into that process and bringing them back to those organic authorities. So if you don't do that, they're just moving along, and things, they end up changing law de facto by nobody calling them and checking them on it.
Yeah, that's the part that I think a lot of people don't understand, is that, yeah, a lot of it is rules. Well, those rules have to be rooted in law. They have to have passed a law through the elected representative process. Then the rules come from that. So if they can't show you the law that backs up the rule, game over. But not a lot of people think to ask that. And sometimes it's super complicated and little, you know, Especially, like, I don't know if you want to talk at all about the grizzly bear thing or wolves. We could talk about either one of them. And we see how many corners were cut on wolves.
Yeah, exactly. I'm more familiar personally with the grizzly bear issues in Montana and also Washington State. They actually, right before Thanksgiving, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service put forward a notice of intent to reintroduce a 10J experimental population of grizzly bears into the North Cascade ecosystem in Washington State. And this whole process, we had engaged on this with the Farm Bureau there in some counties the first go-around, because they tried this starting in 2015. And then David Barnhart, Secretary of Interior, in 2020, I believe, terminated that seven-year environmental impact statement due to large local opposition and substantive comment inserted into the record. And this administration, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the National Park Service have, without producing any new information, no new science, no new data relating to the Endangered Species Act and the bear itself, have decided to throw a notice of intent on the Federal Register right before Thanksgiving, as I said, with a 30-day public comment period for the scoping process. Because when they put out a notice of intent in these processes, that begins the environmental impact statement process, the impacts analysis process under the National Environmental Policy Act. So there's a scoping time frame where there's opportunity for the public and other governments to insert comment and substantive information to inform the scope of what that analysis has to consider and the alternatives that need to be looked at. And in this case, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, the only new information that's come into the record on the grizzly bear regarding the Endangered Species Act were a formal petitions put forward by three states, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, calling on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under the ESA to delist the grizzly bear. So that's the only new information and data and comprehensive documentation that's come in to the record in the last 2 years. And instead of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they've missed the deadlines, the 90-day initial deadline, and yesterday was the 12-month deadline to respond to the Montana petition under the ESA. And they haven't even met these statutory deadlines to respond to these state petitions to delist the bear. Meanwhile, they're over in Washington State trying to bring in a non-essential experimental population of grizzly bears in the North Cascade ecosystem. So that gives you a little bit of a picture of how these agencies are functioning and are way off track.
Wow. Well, and they feel like, I mean, you know, I think we've made a fundamental mistake in that we constantly refer to it as federal land. And I had a supervisor up in Siskiyou County who just really got in my face one day. She was a nice lady. And she just got all mad about it. And she goes, "Stop calling it federal land. It's public land. It belongs to us." And I was like, "Okay, you're right.
Good point.
Sorry about that." So now every time I you get ready to say federally, it's like, oh, that's not right. Grace would be very unhappy. It's public. But I think we've forgotten about that. They lock us out. I realize there's a cost to maintain that land. So, you know, you pay to use it. It feels like it belongs to somebody else. And we've kind of given over the control. Which hopefully folks like you will help us get it back. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker. Got the Nathan part wrong, believe it.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body.
All right, Nathan. Where to now? More grizzly bears? We used to have grizzly bears here, actually, Bill was saying on the break. But we got rid of them. They were too destructive and they were killing everything.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. We have a lot of issues in Montana with them. There's, on the first go-around on this process, we put together a death table, which showed all the deaths, maulings, and killings of grizzly bears of individuals, many of which, some of which have been in our Park Service. And the ironic thing is the National Park Service policy actually says that they will not bring in extirpated species if they pose a direct threat to park personnel or park visitors.
Yeah. So,
which means species that are not currently there.
Yeah, extirpated. So like in California, if there's that would be a region maybe within its historic range, but it's been extirpated for like you said, for pretty good reasons. And that's what's happening in Montana. There's sheep allotments in our, because people are like, well, what's the big deal with the grizzly bears? Well, and you mentioned the public or federal land aspect. So what's happening in Montana is it's not only affecting our sheep allotments and cattle allotments and permittees that are in our Forest Service in these regions around the greater Yellowstone and the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem, but it's also limiting legitimate recreational access and utilization of those lands as well. There, for archery season, there's large amounts of areas within those regions that are prohibited because of the presence of the bear. So instead of mitigating the bear to allow the multiple use and sustained yield and the recreational access and utilization of our federal or public lands, they mitigate the human access and the human utilization of it by terminating cattle permitting and setting time frames that the recreating public can or cannot go in and be in particular regions for hunting, fishing, et cetera.
Yeah,
that's problematic.
That doesn't scream management of public land for the benefit of the taxpayer.
Public. Yeah.
You know, and just so we don't gloss over this, I'm always kind of, I don't know, in the back of my mind channeling the opposition, I guess. And so I'm hearing them say, well, they shouldn't be allowed to use that land anyway, grazing and permits and all that. I know what that's about, and I know a lot of our listeners do, but could you sort of, why is that a good thing, and why does that benefit public land and the public?
Yeah, well, it's a good thing, and it's actually a crucial thing, because a huge, vast expanse of our land, in the western United States in particular, both surface and subsurface mineral estate, is administratively managed and overseen by either the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So the rules and regulations and policy frameworks that govern the utilization, access and utilization of the resources that happen to be on all those lands, if we don't have access to those things and the ability to utilize those resources for the benefit, and the Federal Land Policy Management Act specifically says at the out front of that cornerstone statute that governs the administration of those lands, that it is the policy of the Congress of the United States of America that these lands be managed in a way that recognizes a public need for fiber, food, minerals, and wood products. So even our laws, you know, the environmentalists that think we can just leave land there and still have everything that appears on our grocery shelves and the energy that comes into our home to be able to flip a switch and turn a knob on our wall, they're not connecting the dots with the reality of where things materially and energy-wise come from. And much of that in the West, especially in states like Utah and Nevada, but even Montana, we're 35 or close to 40% federally controlled land, not as much as some states, but Utah, the vast amount of the resources that create economic activity and taxable revenue for local governments, for the state. See, that's the thing, is it's not just providing food, fiber, wood products, and material necessities for the population of the nation for national security purposes, et cetera. It's also providing tax royalties and taxable value that, for the most part, local governments are the beneficiaries of. So when they terminate, like Biden did with the XL pipeline in Montana, that pen on a paper terminating that contract for the XL pipeline did away with upwards of $800 million of potential tax revenues for the rural resource-dependent counties in eastern Montana alone, not to mention all the jurisdictions and local municipalities through South Dakota and the other states associated with that. So there's huge problems with saying, well, you shouldn't be able to use that anyways. And for now, unless we let them get away with it, most of our statutory laws and the framework of how those lands are to be administered specifically call for private enterprise in the development and utilization and reclamation of our resources for the needs and benefits of the American people. That's what the law says. That's what the Congress said when they passed over and delegated these responsibilities to our federal departments so that we can still be able to function in the world and in our nation in a way that benefits our neighbor and keeps us in a position, a leadership position in the geopolitical scheme of things as well.
Yeah, because I think there's a mistaken perception that if that land is designated as a national forest, national park, whatever the thing is, that means we don't touch it anymore. It just, we draw a line around it, no one gets to touch it anymore, and it all just manages itself. And out here in the West, that means we have some really big fires.
Well, and also I think they've proven that when we were talking about leasing the land for grazing, taking that out of grazing, the land itself actually benefits from cattle grazing, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, in Montana, not just Montana, but many states, Montana in particular, though, back in the day, early 1900s, there was just in common grazing and utilization of the lands that in some ways was problematic, and you had grazing wars and different things and conflict between sheep herders, cattle, the cattle industry, and different things. And the Taylor Grazing Act came in 1934, and under that act, it withdrew all the federal lands held in the Western Territories from location and entry pending classification of those lands and the best utilization of them. And a lot of those lands were still being disposed of to private ownership and appropriation under the Stock Raising Homestead Act and some other disposal laws. So we need to remember that, too. As much of the real estate was disposed of to private appropriation and ownership, the Taylor Grazing Act, though, there was a huge expanse of lands, 155 million acres, and there's still about 135 million acres to this day that are reserved and classified as chiefly valuable for grazing and the raising of forage crops and have federally cadastral TGA grazing district maps, and through that process over time, there was what developed was an allotment management system, because the stockmen who came in and claimed the 640-acre parcels under the Stock Raising Homestead Act, the requirements for disposal of those lands is, one, you had to be a stockman, and you had to live on the property for 3 or 4 years, and you had to have established permanent improvements. And what happened is that land became what is in law called dependent commensurate property. Because in the West, you know, the homestead laws out east worked well with 180-acre parcels and 640-acre parcels for disposal to private property ownership. Out west in the more arid country, it was not viable for agricultural and economic purposes to have 640 acres of land. So that became dependent commensurate property and was linked to the federal allotments, the grazing allotment system, where those individual, what's called base properties that are owned by individual people in the ag industry, then have grazing rights on those federal allotments. So that has developed over time, and that's been, in some ways, a success in Montana in particular, because we've set up a state grazing district system, statutory framework for state grazing districts pursuant to the Taylor Grazing Act. And we've, so long answer to your question, but yeah, absolutely. Not only just private enterprise and grazing is benefits the land in many cases, but we've developed a rotational grazing system and a process that meets rangeland improvement conditions and other aspects.
Yeah, it isn't just a freeway. You know, people look at it like, oh, well, they're just like cutting the corner and using public land to raise their cows.
stripping the land of anything that's alive, and you know, those grasslands come back every year with grass and not sagebrush and everything else because of grazing. So when you take that out of grazing, if they were to take that land out of grazing, what would happen to it?
Well, that's the problem is, yeah, well, the grasses without grazing would become decadent for the most part. It's just like your lawn. I mean, you need to, grass isn't there just to grow. And I mean, it's in the whole purpose of a blade of grass or a grass is to generate a seed. But, the grazing aspect is a healthy process and a forage process that, is helpful for the range. You leave pasture ungrazed long enough, you know, for a couple years or a year to defer and let it rest is one thing, but to let it sit there and not be utilized for years on end, it doesn't benefit the range, doesn't benefit the grass, and it leads to, just like our forest mismanagement, it becomes just a bigger hazard for fires and other things,
yeah,
as well.
It becomes a massive liability out here, the lack of management. You know, you have people who, oh, we shouldn't cut any trees. You know, the forest will take care of itself. It's like, well, you can't suppress fire and not manage it. You can't do both.
Yep. Exactly. So with the grazing here, the problem here is there, you know, with the American Prairie Reserve, they're not saying we want to stop grazing on all this land. They've bought up a bunch of ranches that are connected, those base properties. They've bought these dependent commensurate properties in the region that are connected to all these BLM grazing allotments. So they may, the APR only owns, you know, the deeded acreage that they have is somewhere around 100, maybe 150,000 deeded acres. But the connection of that to those BLM allotments, they have over 400,000 acres of land. So they're going through permit processes through the Bureau of Land Management right now to transition the class of livestock from cattle to bison, because their goal isn't to remove grazing. They want to remove domestic livestock grazing, but they want to substitute it with this large self-sustaining bison herd. They want to get a 3.5 million acre reserve and have about 10,000 bison roaming out there as a wild. That's their goal, is for a wild population of bison. And so we're engaging on the administrative process on that, because, like I said, the laws and the grazing administration and the regulations that govern those lands, they define livestock, and it's defined as cattle, horses, sheep, burros, and goats. Bison is not among them. The only provision in the grazing regulations that allows bison to be grazed on these lands is a special use permit, and that's an exception to the rule. So, and I don't have a problem with, if the APR was buying just a couple deeded ranches and having some allotments and running bison and managing those bison within the framework, I wouldn't have a problem with that. I don't care if somebody wants to run bison, as long as they follow the process and go through a permitting process to do it, but they don't want to do that. They want to literally subvert the ag industry through the whole region on all these BLM allotments and transition the utilization away from domestic livestock grazing to wild bison.
That seems to be the prevailing sentiment. I mean, if you had to put like a, you know, a header over all of it, it all kind of boils down to, and it's not about people. You know, it's actually contrary to things that benefit humans, typically. So there goes all the food. Goodbye, domestic livestock. We don't need you. We'll be eating, what is it?
That soy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, joy. The joy of soy.
The Impossible Burger.
Yeah. Yeah, the things that actually use a lot more. I think all that, haven't they already proven that all that fake meat, I've never actually eaten it, so I'm kind of, you know, talking off the top of my head here. But the fake meat actually uses more resources to make than beef.
Yeah, it doesn't make
sense. They've done a whole bunch of work on that. It's just, yeah, it makes no sense. But here it is again. You know, people, I don't think people think sometimes that that you would have all these problems. Although, tell me this. I've got to take a break again. Darn it. Okay, when we come back, has the series Yellowstone helped you or hurt you? Because I'm thinking like it might have helped. It's in Montana. Kind of shows what goes on. We'll be right back with our guest, Nathan Dishmaker. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. So if they ever make the Bureaucracies a musical, we could just use that for the theme song. Seems to fit, because I tell you what, I deal with these folks too on different issues than you do, but sometimes, I mean, our congressman here wrote a bill. You know, people say, well, it's because the legislation's too big, that's why. All right, he wrote an amendment to a bill. Was for the Army Corps of Engineers, and it said that the Army Corps of Engineers was prohibited from regulating ongoing farming practices. Simple, pretty straightforward. And they were jacking up a farmer here. He plowed his land, and it rained, and some rain got into the little, you know, the furrows that he had plowed on his farm, and they decided it was a wetlands. It's like, no, it's not a wetlands, knuckleheads. So, I mean, the congressman met with the Army Corps and, you know, said, here, this has been signed into law. You can't do this. And they took the little piece of paper and read the one sentence, and they said, oh, yeah, we remember this. But that's just not the way we read it. At some point.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a couple years ago, that case.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one of the guys that affected is John Duarte, who was just elected to Congress. So I have a feeling he's going to have a special interest in oversight of the Army Corps of Engineers. I'm just thinking.
Just to help him out a little
bit. I'm just thinking that, yeah, that was a really hotly contested race. It was just settled, I don't know, a week ago, maybe, after all this time, and he won by like 600 votes. I mean, it was a toughie. But I'm sure that the Army Corps is like, curses. Here comes Duarte. So, kind of nice. The good guys do win sometimes.
Nathan, getting back to the whole grizzly bear thing.
But I wanted to know about Yellowstone.
Oh, okay. You do that, and then we'll go back to it.
Yeah, because I want to know about Yellowstone. Do you think that helps you guys or hurts you guys?
I don't have much comment on that. I personally haven't watched the show, and I know people that have watched it, and so I I don't know, I guess, whether one way or the other. I know that it's a show that's brought a lot of attention, but like I said, I personally haven't watched any of it to comment on.
Yeah, I guess
mean,
I wasn't
I'm hearing
looking
about it, but
yeah, not like critique of the series or anything, because there's always stuff, you know, people like and don't like and all that.
Yeah.
I just mean it actually I've been fascinated to watch how really kind of accurate they are with how the government and the tribes and the industry and all of that has just lined squarely up on a landowner with the sole purpose of taking his land. They're real clear about it.
Yeah.
And that's happening everywhere. That is not a one-off, and that is not a made-for-TV thing. That is happening all over the place. And I thought, oh, my gosh. Typically, when they make shows about that, you know.
Yeah, the landowner is the big bad wolf.
Yeah, landowner's the bad guy. And in this case, he's not blameless. No. But it really does a good job about how the policy gets skewed. So, sorry.
Well,
back to
in that context, I think it would provide, you know, it's giving a lot of people maybe an eye into some of those issues that landowners have to deal with. Like I said, I haven't seen the program, but like it's just like the farmer down there with the furrows and Army Corps of Engineers saying this is a navigable water, and because you planted a spring wheat crop, you know, we're going to fine you this much a day. I mean, it's just way out of control. In that respect. So maybe the show in that sense, yeah, like you said, it may give opportunity to have a viewing of a lot of people that otherwise wouldn't have a picture of what those things look like.
Yeah, so few people live in that environment. They do, the other thing they do a really good job of portraying is the tie of the people to the land and how well they care for their land and what they think about their land and the history and their animals and how seriously they take all of that. I mean, these aren't people they're pillaging. They're planning on living there for another 150 years. And that, I think, sometimes gets lost, especially in the environmental discussion. They make it sound like, I know here in Northern California, they make it sound like these people have just rolled in out of nowhere. They're going to take everything they can get off the land and then leave. And it's like, well, if they were going to do that, wouldn't they have done that 100 years ago? You know, it just doesn't make sense.
Yep. Well, and on that note, it's good to hear that individuals coming into office or is in office that was associated with that case. Because another thing I've been really tracking is really the systemic problems of just that, of agencies going way off from their delegated authority. And part of the problem is in our courts. Our courts have given broad deference to these executive agencies in interpreting their own statutory authorities. So one of the reasons Army Corps of Engineers responds to your congressman and looking at some statute and saying, well, that's not the way we read that. One of the reasons they're saying that is because the Chevron deference, the Baltimore and Gas deference, the Auer deference, there's a bag of bad case law where the federal courts have deferred to the agencies to interpret their own statutory authority in being challenged, which that's, you know, very, very problematic. But I will say, so I've been reading a book by Neil Gorsuch, published in 2018, I believe. And in that book, and I'm just going to reference this because it ties into what we're talking about, like with that farmer in the Army Corps of Engineers. The book is called A Republic If You Can Keep It. And in that book, he says, on this record, how can anyone fairly say that Congress intended for courts to abdicate their statutory duty under the Administrative Procedures Act and intended to delegate away its legislative power to executive agencies? The fact is, Chevron's claim about legislative intentions is no more than a fiction, and the one that requires a pretty hefty suspension of disbelief at that. And he goes on and says that Chevron is nothing more than a judge-made doctrine to abdicate the judicial responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So we, and this is rolling, this isn't just in a book by Gorsuch, published in 2018. This ties into the major questions issue that is coming before the Supreme Court. The OSHA case triggered the major questions. West Virginia versus EPA triggered the major questions. Social cost of carbon litigation, our state attorney generals are bringing forward, that's percolating to the Supreme Court now, is pressing the major questions. And what is the major questions? The major questions doctrine is when an agency action has vast economic and political significance and is not expressly delegated by the executive branch. At that point, the court no longer defers to the agency, and they look at the statute and they apply the law. And that's what happened in the West Virginia case. That's what happened in the OSHA case. That's what's hopefully going to continue to happen in some of these major questions cases that are coming up to the courts. Because one of the reasons you have Army Corps of Engineers and these agencies saying, well, that's not our reading of this, is because they've been given free rein by the judiciary to interpret its own statutory authorities. Very, very problematic.
Yeah, and that just feeds on itself, because we've seen that, like with the Klamath dams, we've seen it with the Klamath project up here on the Southern Oregon and Northern California side, where when the Bureau of Reclamation makes bad decisions on water policy for water they don't own, that is owned by the people on the project, by the irrigators on the project. But the federal government has acted like it's their water for so long that now it's impossible for the actual owners of the water to get that back. And the courts won't help them. It's in federal court, but they refuse to hear the case. Therefore, the case is decided. You lose.
Well, and the cost of that is... Yeah, so how do you fight that, you know? And one thing we're doing is we're equipping the lesser magistrates in our land, because county commissioners and our local governments really they don't have the resources and the ability and the technical support to be able to traverse the bureaucratic rulemaking process, especially within the deadlines and timeframes that you have to get in there and equip the record. And one of the reasons we're not winning in the courts isn't just because there's some bad case law out there. It's also because we, from the conservative front, have failed to equip the public record. The environmental side, they win so many Administrative Procedures Act cases because they are equipping the record with substantive comment every time the door is open. We conservatives tend to wait till the rule's out the door and they've already done the action, and then we go and litigate on it. And a handful of times we may win on a case if it's big enough and if it's significant enough. But if we're not, so what we focus on, or want to focus on, my focus is taking all this conservatives are putting out excellent information. We have think tanks out there that are developing excellent resources, data, science, legal analyses, etc. But what we're not doing is we're not taking that good information and applying it in the administrative rulemaking process. And that's what we're doing on these federal rulemakings, is equipping the record. We did that in Montana on the American Prairie Reserve Initiative. They opened an environmental assessment for these permits in 2017. And we have equipped the record. We turned what otherwise would be a three-month EA. We did exactly what the environmental group does to us. We turned a three-month EA into almost 5 years now. And now, because of the great work that we did on the ground through our counties and our state grazing districts, we equipped the record so well that when we had a new governor and AG come in, they took the work that we had equipped in the record, and now these permits are now going through federal appeals court. With the full weight of our attorney general's office and our governor's office bringing that forward.
How?
So we don't know what's going to happen in that, but,
sure.
But the fact that we did the groundwork gave a foundation for our state then to step in and continue that forward.
How do, I can hear people wondering, how do regular people do this? You know, like, what's a good resource for people that are thinking, I need to get involved in this, but I haven't got the vaguest idea where to start? And they're all, you know, they're kind of on their own. Are there any good groups to jump in with? Or, you know, you don't have to necessarily give it to me right this minute, but we can post that for people. Because I think a lot of people who live in the rural parts of the country, which is the bulk of the country, not the bulk of the population, but the bulk of the landmass, is rural. Yeah. And they're all being affected by this in some form or fashion. They go to a lot of public meetings. I'm not going to call it a mistake, because it isn't a mistake, but it does wind up being ineffective, even though it's wrong that it should be ineffective. They arm themselves with the science, and people think that facts matter. And these guys mow right over them.
Yeah, well, you have very well-funded environmental organizations and a very well-funded bureaucracy that are paralleled together in the environmental philosophy that's being driven down through these federal rulemaking processes. So how do ordinary people get involved? Well, you know, with me personally, I wouldn't be doing much of what I'm doing. My background's in theology, studying the word, law, history. And, you know, from my perspective, studying the Bible, the Bible is a self-interpreting document. It interprets itself. Anybody can cherry-pick from the scriptures and get a verse to say what it, just like these agencies do. They come in and, oh, here's a statute from NEPA that gives us the authority to do this. You know, when Jesus was tempted in the wilderness by Satan himself and he said, turn this stone into bread, and cited a statute from Deuteronomy that gave him the authority to do that, did Jesus put his hands up in the air and say, oh, you got me. There's the law. What do I do? No, Jesus applied the doctrine of in paramateria, which is that all like-kind statutes are to be interpreted as a whole. And he went to another passage in statute in Deuteronomy and countered it. So that's essentially, that's a biblical analogy, which, like I said, that's where I come from in my, and that's our heritage, by the way. Our laws, because we had Bible-believing Christian men and women that were instrumental in establishing the system of our Republican representative government, our law functions in the same way. The doctrine of in paramateria that was applied in that text is also a doctrine alive and well within our legal system. It's been allowed to go dormant. So for ordinary folks to get involved, it starts with just connecting yourself with the fundamental principles of our system in our constitutional republic, understanding the basic principles of freedom and liberty and life, liberty, and property. You have to start from principles. Otherwise, you get into the bureaucracy and you're incapable of even, you get overwhelmed and you're incapable.
You're ensnared at that point and there's no way out. Let's pick up with that on the other side of the hour when we come back. Because I think that's really important. If you can tie the things that you've been working on to things people might do or might begin to do in their own local place, that would be awesome. You're listening to We the People. We'll be back with you. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh!
Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad.
Second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Who's our sponsor, Bill?
Our sponsor, who's one of many, is Pape Machinery. And they're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. And they can take care of all your tractor needs up there. They have a good supply of John Deere tractors in stock, John Deere mowers, attachments. They got it all. Go up and see them. They do parts and service as well. But go up and see them or give them a call. The phone number is 530-226-9226.
Hello.
Or catch them on the web at papaymachinery.com.
There you have it.
There you are.
All right. We're going to jump right back in it. We're here with Nathan Deshmaker, and we're talking about defending our rural resources is what I called it, just because that's really what it all boils down to. And our country is loaded with resources, and unfortunately, through just policy ensnarements, not necessarily our laws, but the policy that's enacted by the agencies that are supposed to be managing our public land, our resources are either being wasted or just unused or wrecked. In the West, I mean, we have timber resources coming out our ears. At least we did till we burned down 1 million acres a year or more.
Yeah.
So Nathan's working on the policy side, going through all the rules, all those terrific rules that they use against us because we don't know them. That's the bottom line, huh, Nathan? The public just doesn't know the rules.
Cutting out on my end.
Oh, we are? Oh, maybe we better call you again or something because you sound perfect. How is that? Weird? Oh, the fact that he's not saying anything gives me a clue.
I'll go ahead and call him back.
Okie dokie.
Get this all sorted.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I'd kind of like him to go back to is this policy that they're wanting to reintroduce the grizzly bears into the Washington area. This reminds me of when they reintroduced the wolves, and when they did that, they had a plan to maintain the population
right.
At around 400 animals over a certain area. And at that point, once they reached that level, then they would delist them and then also control their population through special hunts and so forth. Problem is they never went back to that. They let that population just expand and move completely outside the borders of what they had originally planned, and now
because they're wild animals,
they're wild animals,
and an apex predator,
and so you know we can't control that. So they've just basically let that population run wild, and the local cattle ranchers, sheep herders, and so forth have suffered greatly because of that plan, and they're still not really doing a lot to manage that population growth. And I don't think a lot of people realize, but wolves populate like rats. I mean, they take over an area, and if there's food, they're going to keep growing and expanding. I kind of see the same thing happening with grizzlies, only I think it's a little more serious with a grizzly bear. I mean, you open your back door and there's a grizzly standing there. You're not in your back door anymore.
Nobody lives in your house anymore.
No, you're being drug out into the woods and eaten. I mean, just ask the people up in Alaska that live with grizzlies. There's areas you don't go, and you certainly don't go there unless you're armed. And they still lose a lot of people up there because of grizzly bears. And I guess that's going to be okay if they do this and you live in Washington, well, then it's your problem if you can't get along with grizzlies.
And just like the wolves, though, if you shoot them, good luck. They did that on that show Yellowstone, too. There were wolves that were killing their cattle. And they shot them and realized they were collared, so they were being tracked by Fish and Wildlife. And they were like, uh-oh. Not that they could have known that necessarily from a distance, but They took the collars off and strapped them to wood and floated them down the river, which didn't really work out so good.
No.
We don't know what actually turned out with that yet. But, I mean, people are put in really bad situations with all of this, and you're supposed to be compensated if they kill your livestock, but the standard to receive compensation is so high that either you can't meet it or it's
exactly. And you know, with the wolves, yeah, they're a dangerous animal. If you're out there in their habitat and they want to attack you, they will. But in most cases, they're as much afraid of you as you are of them.
Well, that's what the environmentalists all said, but that hasn't actually borne out necessarily.
They'll track you and they'll hunt you. But grizzly bears are known to track people and.
Yeah, Nathan, what's the rhetoric up there in the meetings about all this? Are they doing like what they did with us with wolves? Oh, it's no big deal. They won't go after people. It'll be fine. Are they doing that to you too?
Well, you know what's really ironic? So the draft environmental impact statement for this first go around in the North Cascade ecosystem in Washington, they said because we're going to be picking grizzly bears that largely have a herbal diet, they won't be as prone to depredating or attacking people as the greater Yellowstone grizzly bears.
We're going to pick vegetarian grizzly bears. That's terrific.
Yeah, that's literally what they're saying, and they're trying to carry that same reasoning forward in this scoping process. And so, yeah, but the thing is, all of the information, the depredation side of this, or bears, I guess. So I have three sources, and it's funny because U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also referenced these same authors and books. So three different sources debunk that idea. One is Anderson from 2002, stating that depredation event counts suggest that as more grizzly bears become spatially associated with livestock, they kill livestock at higher levels, which could indicate that bears depredated on livestock opportunistically rather than a few problem bears repeatedly depredating. So he's saying this isn't just a problem bear issue. As bears become more distributed and associated with livestock. And then Wells in 2017 said grizzly bears are opportunistic omnivores. Gunther in 2004 said livestock depredation by grizzly bears in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem from 92 to 2000 has been found to be unrelated to the availability of bear foods. And that conclusion is based on the fact that they're finding depredation and looking around and seeing all these berry bushes, and they're like, this doesn't make sense. The bear ate the cow even though there's a berry bush right there. It's like, well, it's because they, and then if they get a taste of meat and protein, that's what they prefer because they're going to build a lot better fat and a lot better everything they need to get through the winter by eating your cattle or fish or meat protein than scrubbing berries off the mountainside.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're going to build a lot of fat there.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's
problematic.
And none of that factors into their process, right?
Well, we insert these are the types of things that I do research and analyze and look in and actually read through. So that's the thing you mentioned earlier. How do people get involved at the local level? If you're more of an academically minded person and you're a researcher, and you're good at researching and going down that path, maybe there's a potential you could do similar work that I do, which is actually reading through those impact statements and look at the reasoning. Because the CEQ regulations for implementing the National Environmental Policy Act says that agencies shall make explicit reference by footnote to the scientific or other sources relied upon for conclusions in the statement. They did not put a single footnote or scientific reference on the statement that these are going to be vegetarian bears in that conclusion. So one of the ways you deal with that in the comment process on an impact statement like that is you call that out and you cite the sources. You do what they're not doing, and you put that's what I call equipping the public record. You analyze their impacts analyses. You identify where they're coming to conclusions without citing the sources, and then you actually do the homework and find out what's really going on and cite the references and sources, and you take them to task on it. Not only did you not cite references, you're actually misleading public opinion because you're ignoring peer review literature on the same subject.
So in their plan to reintroduce, have you seen the numbers? How many bears are they talking about reintroducing into this area?
Well, it would be an incremental process over time. The goal, the number they throw out is 200 to get eventually to 200 bears in the North Cascades. So here's another thing so in Montana, what's happened is agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service, state and federal departments have projected through modeling population growth and dispersion of bears outside of the region of influence. Those models, and then they use those predictive methodologies to go forward with no action on mitigating the bear. And those predictive methodologies, after we observed and have the empirical data of population increase and dispersion in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem, were 25% to 40% off. They were predicting this much population increase and this much dispersion. They dispersed 20% to 40%. They populated and dispersed 20% to 40% more than what they were predicting in their predictive methodologies. And like I said, they use those predictions as an excuse not to mitigate the dispersion of the bear. And those predictions have shown come to be flawed. They don't meet the rigor and the standards that's required for agencies and the science they use to make those types of determinations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another area you could call them out is, and we have that data. They're speculating and using these predictive methodologies. We're looking at the data that's available in Montana because we have 1,000 bears over 1,000 bears in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem and over 800 in the Greater Yellowstone. A lot of grizzly bears.
Wow.
And they're dispersing way outside the original region of influence.
Mm-hmm. Now, how will this affect the native black bear population? Are they going to coexist, or is this going to drive the black bears further out into populated areas?
You know, I don't know a direct answer to that other than to say, like in Washington, in the Northern Cascades, they do have a black bear population there, and they already have some issues just even dealing with the black bears, but I assume that they would coexist to some extent, but there's potential problems there.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I haven't looked into that personally of the interrelationship between black bears and grizzlies, though.
Yeah, well, I know they have a fairly substantial black bear population in this area. They've outlawed hunting with dogs, so you know that drives the numbers up. And I'm curious to see once they introduce the grizzlies, what that population is going to do in Washington. With the wolves, they introduced them in Oregon, and it wasn't even a year later they were already in California. So I'm sure they're going to migrate down the West Coast, and we'll have, because they're going to go where the food is, and there's plenty of food in Washington and Oregon and Northern California, you know, with the deer populations and so forth. I guess I'm really shocked that they would think that in any way that's a good idea.
And that they can control it.
And they can control it, exactly.
That's the bigger one.
Yeah.
So what's happening so Montana's petitioned to delist the bear. One of the main arguments the state is making is that as long as that animal remains threatened on the endangered species list, the state's police powers are tied behind their back. Our state... Montana has had a long history of grizzly bears. We have the capacity at the state level, through hunting and all sorts of other mechanisms to mitigate the bear and protect life, limb, and property in the state of Montana. But as long as that bear stays listed and threatened on the Endangered Species Act, those police powers are essentially, extremely limited. So for that reason, because the grizzly bear, the scientific name for it is the Ursus Arctis or whatever. It is stable in population and increasing across its whole Arctic range. Tens of thousands of them are in existence. It is a species of least concern in the international scientific community. So the thing is, so ultimately, reluctance or delays in delisting a recovered species such as the grizzly bear significantly limits a state's ability to protect life, limb, or property. So for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to not to address the grizzly delisting issue while at the same time seeking to introduce a non-essential experimental population into an extirpated region constitutes, in my opinion, an intrusion into the police powers reserved by the federal and state constitutions to state and local governments.
Absolutely.
So we have federalism implicated. These are structural issues. This is not just an issue of a department putting a bear out there and not managing it. We have federalism implications in these processes. The bear under the ESA is recovered. Aurelia Skipwith, in her Senate confirmation to Fish Wildlife Service 2 years ago, said that to the senator out of Wyoming, that the gray wolf and the grizzly bear are functionally recovered for the purposes of the ESA. So ultimately, with them going forward with this and trying to bring bears into the NCE and Washington State while ignoring these other state petitions is a inappropriate primacy by executive agencies that's intruding into the locally reserved police powers of those states and state and local governments to protect their property rights interests and the constituents that live within their jurisdictions.
Right.
Amen.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And we're seeing that with a bunch of other things, and it's always a nefarious purpose, like getting rid of livestock, that sort of thing. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come right back since Nathan's on a roll, coming back quick. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Keep a 45 by your bed. That'd help you sleep.
You can work with Nathan and keep the federal government out of your house. It is scary for people, though. I mean, all of this, because it seems so completely overwhelming and out of control.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, it comes back to, like I said earlier, you have to start from the principles. And what we ended on coming into that break, the principle, and it's called federalism, and it's called the separation of powers. Article 1, legislative, Article 2, executive, and Article 3, you have the judiciary. And then Article 4 of the Constitution is the guarantee to the states a republican form of government. And then latter amendment with the 10th and 9th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is the reservation of powers. See, these agencies and state departments that we're working with, they have enumerated powers. State and local governments have unenumerated powers. There is a vast amount of residual power aggregated at the local level of government. So back to the grizzly bear issue is, you have to deal with this procedurally. We're not going to win on these issues by trying to fight all the science and all this different stuff. We need to include the science. We need to understand the data that's there and call it out when we can. But so just one quick thing back to the federalism. So there's an executive order still on the books. I believe it was a Reagan-era executive order, or maybe it was actually even Clinton might even sign this one. But it's an executive order dealing with federalism implications. That order says that that the order was issued in order to ensure that the principles of federalism established by the framers guide the executive departments and agencies in the formulation and implementation of policies and to further the policies of the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act, and that federalism is rooted in the belief that issues that are not national in scope or significance are most appropriately addressed by the level of government closest to the people, end quote. Very clear.
Yeah.
Who is that? That's the county officials that are elected in that local jurisdiction. That's your state magistrates. That's where these things should be addressed. But we have our federal counterparts entering into a domain that historically, under our system of government, has been left to state prerogatives. That's where we are.
Well, I think
the grizzly bear.
No, sure. but I think a lot of that stems from counties accepting and being afraid of losing federal funding on a lot of other things, and I think that's the leverage they have. Is, you know, you go along with us on this, or we're going to pull your funding on that, and it's just gotten so out of hand at this point. I think this whole thing with the feds coming in and funding local programs, yeah, it benefits.
The land of grants.
Yeah, it just leaves us beholden to the federal government, and now everybody's afraid to lose what little money they have, which is a bad position to be in.
Yeah. Well, we're getting grants from the same agencies, departments, and NGOs that are systematically destroying the industries that provide our tax base.
I agree.
That's what's happening in Montana. Our coal industry has been not destroyed, but hamstrung. And guess what? Our local conservation districts traditionally have been forever funded by the royalties from coal mining.
Mm-hmm.
And look at that. We're going to allow access and utilization of an important resource for the energy of this state and the rest of the nation and the world, because we export a lot of coal out of Montana. We're not burning it here, but we're shipping it to Japan and China right now by the train load. And last I checked, we live in the same atmosphere. So there's a big problem with outsourcing. We're not stopping the industries. We're outsourcing them to other countries. And like I said, there's tax implications to this. We've hamstrung the funding for our local conservation districts, so therefore, exactly, what are our conservation districts now? Basically, units of local government that are 100% dependent. Some of our districts have to basically show a negative on the balance sheet at the end of the year to get the administrative grants we need just to carry forward baseline administrative costs to keep the district even in an office in the county.
Right.
That's where we are. But instead of us being like, hey, we need to actually bring back our coal industry and have these tax bases, we're more worried about going to the legislature to get all the marijuana money that's available now to fund our conservation districts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where we are in Montana, and not just Montana. I'm sure other states are facing the same things. But when these industries go, we're not only losing the material resource that provides cheap, affordable products for us as the people of this nation, we're also losing the taxable revenue that those industries generate that fund our local governments.
Well, they've done the same thing in mm-hmm. Northern California with the timber industry. The timber receipts funded our schools and roads and everything else, and they've pretty much, I mean, we still have logging in California, but not to the scale that it was. I mean, we had mills in all these Northern California towns, and very few mills left.
Yeah, we're importing our lumber from Canada.
Yeah, we import our lumber, and
so not many that we're not of these, using it.
Yeah, and so many of these schools now, they don't get those timber receipts. They don't have the money to operate like they used to, and so again, like you said, they're just totally dependent on these federal funds to keep going, and that's where they've got these counties hamstrung. We've got to take the control back and reopen some of these industries that aren't damaging the ecology and the environment like they want everybody to believe. But man, they've done a great job of shutting it down.
Yeah. Well, in the, you know, you had the war on coal with Obama administration. Now we have the third administration and Biden coming forward from that agenda that's all out assault on our oil and gas industries. You know, what the commercial break, that's what one of the things that was said is, I mean, we've lessened our oil reserves to the level it hasn't been since the 80s. And now we're buying, just like you said, we're buying timber from Canada. Well, we're buying a bunch of oil and gas now from other countries, sometimes hostile and communist-based systems of government, mm-hmm. who have unregulated industries that are developing those resources. And we're buying that to replenish our reserves. I mean, it's an absolute... It's really sad is what it is, being an American citizen who cares about our heritage and the blood, sweat, and tears that our forefathers went through to guarantee to us a Republican form of government, which basically take away all the legalese out of it. That means there's a separation of powers within government to protect you, the individual person. That's what it boils down to. And when we have government in a position that it can just come in through the executive branch and impact vast sectors of economic activity, which is what happens when you attack the oil and gas industry and you withdraw finance from those industries, which is what they're doing. There is an energy crisis is an everything crisis. See, the problem is the net zero economists over in, you know, at the UN and even in our country and high levels of government, they view energy as just another input into the economic system. But in reality, energy is actually the hub from which all other economic transactions come in and out of. So they're philosophically, from an economic perspective, standing on a false understanding of how things function in the modern economic framework, and they're tampering with the hub that gives the foundational basis. Energy is everything in relationship to getting cheap, affordable, and reliable and sustainable products to the people. And we're not talking about just a smartphone that you don't necessarily need. I'm talking about the food you put in your refrigerator and the lights you turn
on. Talking about civilization as a whole.
That, and I was just going to say, that was the turning point in civilization. That's when things really sped up, was when we found a way to have oil and gas and, you know, heat our homes without spending all day cutting wood.
Expensive energy, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, where'd oil come from before that?
Mm-hmm.
Whales.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the thing, is it was an environmental success, too. I mean, the automobile actually cleaned up our cities. Respiratory disease and rates in our cities before the automobile were way out the roof. I mean, New York had, 50,000 horses and carriages in that city walking around, carrying people around and pooping and peeing all day long in the street. It wasn't a
clean, pristine
environment.
You know, I mean, the legendary pictures of London where you basically couldn't see anybody. Shoot, we even made...
All the wood burning and
the coal. I mean, Mary Poppins. Right? We even made children's movies about it.
That's what they want to go back to for some reason.
I don't even know if they want to go back to anything in particular. I'm not... this is just totally, obviously, an opinion thing, but I'm curious. Do you think they actually have a goal of... like a destination in mind, or do you think it's just all about saying no and crushing forward progress. Like, do you think they have a plan?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a plan, but it's, like I said, their plan's based on a false philosophical foundation at the get-go. They're not intentionally, these people, I don't think, understand the implications. And this is, if you study economics, you understand this. The root of all of our troubles lies in the fallacy that the best way of ordering economic affairs is to place the responsibility for all crucial decisions in the hands of the state. And this error, driven to its logical conclusion, as it is now being driven by those who have been put into power, can bring upon us untold miseries and humiliations of which the past couple of years have given us a foretaste. The central planners, they have an economic plan, and that's what the climate policy agenda is all about. Climate policy and the climate change agenda is nothing more than the mechanism to get the free economies of the West to sell their birthright for a pot of stew. It's a mechanism for it's the age-old gold for a centrally planned economy. And it's not new. It's been something that we've always, as a free people, had to throw off. And that's part of the tribal way of thinking and doing things. So that's why it attacks individualism. That's why it attacks the institution of the home and the family. Because the home and the family is a support system for who? The individual. They want to sever the natural laws and support systems to individual people to create a dependency on the state. So that's the plan. Whether the implications that brings about is what they're not taking into consideration, which is suffering and a violation of the fundamental rights of individual people that is laid out in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, and that never ends well. You know, when you do that to a population and you start to crush people down, they might be somewhat compliant at the beginning, but they don't stay that way. I don't know. I really think that they fundamentally misunderstand their own place in all this. They think somehow everybody's just going to roll over and let them, be the boss of them, as we used to say when we were kids. And I don't think that's actually going to happen. That's going to be. I believe that'll be surprising for a lot of these.
You always
folks.
Wonder, you know, how bad does it have to get before people say enough's enough? And I think we're starting to see a little bit of that now. But I think it's going to get a whole lot worse before it gets better.
They're going to have to figure it out. You already see it, like with the agencies, like here, they want to have their meetings down in Sacramento, which is, 2.5 hours from the city that we're currently in, which is 1.5 hours from the city up north where our friend Debbie Bacigalupi is, and where, like, all the Wolf meetings and stuff, they were having them in Sacramento. Well, it wasn't going to affect Sacramento. It was going to affect people up there. So they just...
Yep.
They move it so that they don't actually have to face the people who live there. But those folks who are doing a lot of jobs similar to yours, running cattle ranches and things, they've got to take time to drive to some far-reaching place to sit in a room and listen to a bunch of nutty talk about how, you know, wolves will be scared away if you put little rags on your fence. And they neglected to note that you're not fencing an acre. I mean, this is thousands of acres. We've got to take one more quick break, and then we'll come back with Nathan up to the top of the hour. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at
wethepeopleradio.us.
You are faithful, faithful. I'm leaving doubt and sorrow in the distance. I'm gonna trust and cast my fears aside. My life's a work that I know you'll finish. I know I'm gonna be all right. Guys fall down.
from, then you gotta teach them about freedom. You gotta win it, gotta put yourself smack dab in it.
Way back in the 70s, we even knew that.
Yeah, they knew it was coming.
They wrote music for us for the future. God bless them. It's very helpful. But we thought we'd play some songs from the Wayback Machine since you're younger than we are. Nathan, I know we have successfully burned through almost 2 hours of your day, but in our last, 10, 12 minutes or whatever, what else do people need to know? I mean, things that they probably aren't hearing about, perhaps, that you guys are working on that they ought to wise up to.
Well, maybe I'll do two things.
All right.
We got about, 10, 15 minutes or so.
Yeah.
I'm going to circle back and touch on Gorsuch again and what's happening in the courts.
Okay.
And what these, and just read, I want to read a couple things directly from him that ties in well to our conversation. And then we can maybe shift and just summarize with local home rule and the importance of, it's got to start on the ground and where you are. So, but anyway, so with that, let me just read just a quick, not much here, just a, I don't know, four sentences or something. And this is out of that book, Republic, If You Can Keep It, Neil Gorsuch. Actually, I said 2018, published 2019. He says, if an agency can enact a new rule of general applicability affecting huge swaths of the national economy one day and reverse itself the next, you might be forgiven for asking, where's the substantial guidance in that? And if an agency can interpret the scope of its statutory jurisdiction one way, one day, and in reverse itself the next, you might well wonder, where are the promised, clearly delineated boundaries of agency authority? Add to this the fact that today many administrative agencies wield vast powers and are overseen by political appointees, and you have a pretty potent mix. Under any conception of our separation of powers, I would have thought powerful and centralized authorities, like today's administrative agencies, would have warranted less deference from other branches, not more. It is an arrangement, too, that seems pretty hard to square with the Constitution of the Founders' design, and as Justice Felix Frankfurter once observed, quote, the assertion of dangerous power does not come in a day, it does come, however slowly, from the generative force of unchecked disregard of the restrictions imposed by the Constitution, end quote.
Boy, that's powerful.
Sitting Supreme Court Justice.
Yeah.
Wrote that and published it.
Yeah.
You know what he's saying?
Yeah.
Give us a case.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
Does that not resonate with the little tiny chip we chipped off the block of the issue within the administrative state of our day? I mean, in different words, I just read that directly from a sitting Supreme Court justice from a publication 2-3 years ago. And the case law out there is saying the same thing. In the West Virginia versus EPA case, Gorsuch wrote a whole concurrence to that on the major questions. And he cited a case law, and I can't wait to use it. And it says, neither can agencies hide elephants in mouse holes. That is a so Gorsuch cited that case in this concurrence. I was like, man, I never saw that one before. That is a good one.
That is. So,
but this is so that's not just a book he published. These citations. You read Gorsuch, if you haven't read it, I encourage you to get that West Virginia versus EPA case and read through the concurrence that Gorsuch put forward on that. It is very powerful, and they're pushing those separation of powers principles that as part and parcel of what I was talking about from, because it ties into what we do from the local side of things, because those separation of powers, where the power should be, the local home rule power, just like Madison said, the Constitution is parchment. The only thing that gives it any power is a thorough knowledge of the people. And Neil Gorsuch said in this book that one of the main reasons he wrote this book was to get across the vital responsibility of each American, each one of you, to keep our republic strong.
Yeah, and I think that's the root of the whole problem right there, is as these agencies step up and make rules, not laws, and then we bend and abide by their rules, this is what we get. And until people are tired of being stepped on, I think they're going to continue, because they know they can. And that's why I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better, because they're kind of on a roll right now where they can pretty much do whatever they want. Particularly with this administration. I mean, look at our border. I mean, it's completely out of control, and it's going to get a lot worse when Title 42 is abandoned. And what then? I mean, people have got to realize that we're going down a bad road right now, and it has the potential of becoming much, much worse. So I don't know.
Well, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is when good men do nothing. And so I guess our responsibility is to do what we can to, and that's, you know, even being on a ranch and doing the work we do on a day-to-day basis. Like, my stepfather passed away 8 years ago, and which is one of the reasons I got thrusted onto the ranch. And, you know, I've always had to come down to the end of the day with my wife and say the only way to guarantee what God has for us tomorrow is to do what he's called us to do today. That's our duty. That's our responsibility. And I'm just appealing people back to our heritage, to our oaths of office, because the Marxists, if you study Marxism and communism and their whole philosophy and their journals on how they, you know, Antonio Gramsci's prison diaries, where he talks about how the Judeo-Christian principles are so entrenched in Western civilization that the only way that we can really dismantle Western civilization is by taking a long march through the institutions to sever the people from their heritage. So if the communists know this, and they're doing it, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
So what is our response to that? Stay connected to our heritage. And that's why even in the Old Testament, God was so adamant about that with Israel, is teach these things to your kids and their kids. Remind them of how God has delivered you through the wilderness and brought you to a land that you had not known. You know, keep these things instilled. And, you know, 3-4 generations down the road, what were they doing? They were bringing the idols of Baal into the temple and worshiping the gods facing to the east. And what happens is then you add God's judgment on top of the communist approach to dismantle and sever a people from their heritage. So we need to, and I'm coming to the conclusion that the most important thing that we can do individually is first understand our heritage, understand where we come from as a people, and that establishes principles that you live by in all of life. And if you're like me and you're into policy stuff and you're able to work in that field, you take those principles and you apply them there.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think one of the problems we're facing today is more and more people don't have those principles. They're not from here. They weren't raised with those principles, and slowly things are being diluted. But I truly believe there's still more people out there that believe in those principles, and I think they just need to wake up and see what's happening here, because we're being infiltrated with these communist ideas, and even our young people are looking at it going, well, it can't really be that bad. I mean, what are their parents teaching them that they would be? And it's not just the parents. It's our academia is teaching them that this is the way to go, that, you know, the government has all the answers and they'll take care of you. And it's just,
that's always worked out well throughout history.
Oh, it really has.
You know, when the government takes care of you.
And you hear them say, oh, well, you know, they're good ideas. We just need to do them differently. We can do it better. It never works that way. I mean, history's taught us it doesn't work that way. Once they get power, they pretty much wield it, and then you're in a really hard place to fight it. So I don't know. I think it's going to start with the young people to really understand our history, understand where we come from, and then understand where these other countries have fought these same battles with communism and socialism, and they always end up the same.
Yeah, it never.
Well,
ends well.
What one note on that really quick is another thing I've been pondering recently is, you know, when God starts with a people, he starts with a home and a family. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't go to some righteous, city or some righteous state government or some righteous body of government out there. Started with a home and a family in his original creation, and even when he started over, when he looked upon the earth and saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and it grieved him in his heart that he even made man on the earth, and then Noah and his family found favor in the eyes of the Lord. God works through individual people in homes and families. That's where it starts.
Mm-hmm.
It starts in our homes, starts in our families. We need to. Thomas Hobbes said, "Justice is the keeping of covenants; injustice is the breaking of covenants." And that starts in our homes, to our communities, and then our civic responsibilities. And if we just keep covenant, problem is we're breaking covenant across the board in our society.
Right. Oh yeah, they've played that long game for a long, long time now, breaking up families and being more and more dependent, and you know, getting people.
Well, regardless of your age, your family layout, or any of those things, you have to be involved in your community. And if you have people who are fighting and you don't have time to do it, help them. Help them either by showing up at the meetings, fund their efforts, and at the very least, cheer them on. Because that's the only way that we keep everybody in the fight. Nathan, thank you so much. We've got to escape before we get cut off at the pass, but I've posted all your info along with the Gorsuch opinion is on the website at
wethepeopleradio.us.
The armies of the Lord picked up and dusted off their swords, vowed to set the captive free and not let Satan have one more. What if the church, for heaven's sake, finally stepped up to the plate? Stand upon God's promise and storm hell's rusty gates. What if his people prayed? And those who bear his name would only seek his face, yeah, and turn from their own way. And what would happen if we prayed raised up to lead the way? Then maybe kids in school could pray and unborn children see light of day. What if